Okay, this is lecture 25.
We were motivated to discuss the formal path integral, I'll write it with little h, dt, dp, dq, and ask ourselves if we could not play the same game that Gelfand and Jagellon tried to play. We're going to put in a Wiener measure factor, both for p and for q independently. Put a suitable normalization in, n sub nu, and take a limit as the parameter nu goes to infinity, which would formally remove it from this expression. But having the limit outside, we can ask ourselves whether, by putting this term in the middle, we have made things better defined. We began looking at the mathematical side of things, and we recognized that the imposition of the p dot squared and the q dot squared, treating those as the terms that will lead to Wiener measure, leads to paths p and q which are continuous but nowhere differentiable. So we were faced with this term p q dot dt, which we interpreted as p of t dq of t, which is then, since both p and q are Brownian motion, this is to be interpreted as a stochastic integral. We went further and showed that the Stratonovich rule for integration was actually equal to the Ito rule for integration in this case, because the variables p and q actually appear independently here. So these are independent Brownian motions. It's like you're in the plane, p is this way, q is that way. You have a Brownian motion particle, two degrees of freedom, but the horizontal and the vertical parts are independent. So we were free to choose either interpretation, it wouldn't matter. And we are going to choose the Stratonovich, because we know that when we change coordinates, we will have to deal with calculus. You remember how coordinate transformations are defined from one canonical family to another. P bar dq bar equals p dq plus some kind of generator, q and q bar. So this is a kind of calculus here. And if we chose the Ito prescription, we could not use the rule of classical calculus. If we choose the Stratonovich rule, we can use the rule of classical calculus. That's what we found. And I hope you're finding the same thing when you do problem one on the homework, which is due next time we meet on Friday. For those of you who have missed a few homeworks, problem one has been revised or corrected, better way to put it. And I have copies here to hand out to people who would like the corrected version. Okay. So, the main stumbling block that stopped Gelfand and Jagellon, which was interpreting the kinematic type term, they had an x dot squared term before. And that failed for them, but in our case, it's okay. So that means mathematically, we're in good shape. Mathematically, good shape. That didn't mean a heck of a lot. It just means that this expression makes sense. So let me jump to a form for that expression, which is mathematically well defined. So I write PDQ minus HPQ times dt, and then I put the Wiener measure down, depending on the parameter nu, p and q arguments, same Wiener measure we've talked about before, now here for 2 degrees of freedom. So I've taken a great deal of this formal normalization constant into this Wiener measure, and what's left over, interestingly enough, is well behaved. E to the nu times t divided by 2, and what is t? The t is the time we're involved with. There's a 2 pi h bar. Sorry, I need another h bar here. And finally, I take the limit as nu goes to infinity. What I've written down now is an absolutely well-defined mathematical expression. One more time. This is the Wiener measure. We're going to pin it at the initial times. Let's call that p at time 0, q at time 0. That will be called p prime and q prime. We will also have p at capital T, q at capital T. That will be called p double prime and q double prime. So our Wiener measure is of the pinned variety, one for the q's and one for the p's. H is some, let us say, smooth function of the variables p and q, but since the p and q functions are continuous, no problem. PdQ is a stochastic integral, which at the present moment we don't need to worry because Tratanovich and Ito are the same. And in fact, in front we have a prefactor which is finite for every nu, so that means this integral is absolutely well defined. If the integral is well defined, then like any other integral you ever talk about, you can make changes of variables. And when we talk about coordinate transformations, we will be doing just that, making a change of variables in a well-defined integral. But we're not ready for that. Question is, eventually, does the limit exist? That would be nice. Does the result have anything to do with Schrödinger's equation? So I'll put it down, anything to do with quantum mechanics? Does it solve quantum mechanics? I could imagine putting lots of other regularization things in here, which formally disappeared when nu went to infinity, which perhaps the limit would exist, but the result had nothing to do with quantum mechanics. That would not be helpful. So we will find, yes, the limit will exist. The answer will have something to do with quantum mechanics. There will be some technical assumptions on this. Properties of this H for which this will work. I'm not going to prove them. I'm just going to list them at the end of some point in the calculation. But before we go any further, I want to go now from our mathematical discussion to the physical discussion. Let's talk about physics here. Have we helped the physics? I pointed out to you last time we were together that without this regularization term, the original formal path integral was mathematically undefined, and it was physically undefined because you did not know what the meaning of the expression you put in for the Hamiltonian was. You put in the symbol P there. You have no way to know that that should correspond to an anharmonic oscillator. Yes, that guy over in the Wright Union gave me this Hamiltonian, and he said, this is the anharmonic oscillator, but I brought it over here, and it looks like P, and I can't do that.
Did you get a good deal?
I got a good deal on it, I'll tell you that. Okay, what was our secret to understand the physics? The secret was the shadow metric. The shadow metric, we said, something in our pocket for classical mechanics, was a metric we put on phase space, a metric which is normally never a part of classical mechanics. But I said it was useful to have one in your pocket to help understand the physical meaning of the symbol which represents the Hamiltonian. The last time we were together, we showed how that works out.
Well, here we go. What have we got in our regularization? Let me write it over here one more time. PQ dot minus H of PQ dt, new term coming in, 1 over nu. I'll write it as dp squared plus dq squared divided by dt squared, all times dt, curly dp, curly dq, integrate, normalizations, and 11. Now we have the metric put into the problem. The metric is part of the problem. This metric, which we have used classically in our pocket because it was not part of the classical theory, has been brought into the very formulation of the quantum mechanics. This metric will carry the physical meaning of this Hamiltonian. I tell you, this thing is mathematically well defined. If I change coordinates up here, which I'm allowed to do in a well-defined integral, then the functional form of this H will change. But the physical meaning of what that H is has not changed, and it is coded into the transformed version of what the metric will look like. We will see in a short minute, shortly, that choosing the metric to start with in these coordinates will give a very natural meaning to this functional form of the Hamiltonian and associated with the Hamiltonian operator.
Question.
Some reason why you write it as dq squared plus dp squared divided by 1 dp squared?
It's squared.
No, it should be dp. This is a dt. That's a 2. You don't see that. That's a 2. That's a dt squared. That gives me the p dot squared and the q dot squared. Then I have a dt left over.
Okay.
You with me? Okay. Okay, so the metric is now part of the formulation. Also, Dirac told us that we have to use Cartesian coordinates to quantize a canonical system. Here, in my judgment, are the Cartesian coordinates he implicitly had in mind. It's not Cartesian coordinates on the Q alone or the P alone. Indeed, in one dimension for a single Q, there is nothing like a Cartesian coordinate for a single variable. A line is straight only in reference to a higher dimension. So we have Cartesian coordinates now because we have joined Q and P together into a two-dimensional space, the phase space. And these are Cartesian coordinates for both P and both Q in that two-dimensional space. Okay, so when the geometric quantization people tell us we don't need a metric or that we don't need Cartesian coordinates to quantize as was part of their motivation in their program, I can tell them, in my opinion, they are incorrect. What's the current words to use? Crooks and liars.
Okay.
So, metric is now part of the formulation. Its functional form tracks the physical meaning of the symbol HPQ.
Okay, let me conclude by presenting the formal results of the rest of this, if you like, theorem that goes with this.
Tell you
what the answer is. Write down the answer. Limit nu to infinity 2 pi e to the nu t over 2 into the I by h bar p d cube minus h p cube dt d mu nu p cube exists and solves quantum mechanical problem under relatively conservative conditions. That is, the proof has been done, making a certain amount of approximations or inequalities. You may not have the optimal result yet, but under these three conditions, that h p,
excuse me,
yes, sir.
Slight inconsistency in h bars between this expression and this one.
Yes, there should be an h bar. I'm normally working.
Call it another one in front.
H bar, yes. I'm normally working with units of h bar equal 1. In fact, I'm writing a paper currently with h bar equal 1, so I really mixed with two of them. Okay, thank you.
It's the obvious
question. Okay. So these are conditions on the h's. That the integral of h squared with a Gaussian e to the minus alpha p squared plus q squared dp dq is finite for all alpha greater than 0. Condition 2, h, p, and q raised to the 4th power e to the minus beta p squared plus q squared dp dq less than infinity. For some beta less than a half. And condition 3, we're not ready for condition 3.
Your statement for some.
Hello?
For some beta less than a half.
Yes. Okay, so this is a little out of order. We'll have to come back and put in 3 in a minute. Let's figure out what it equals. What does the quantity equal? So let's call this star. Star is clearly a function of several things. It depends on the points where the Brownian motion is pinned. So p double prime, q double prime depends on the time, amount of time separation. Here's the points p prime, q prime, which is the initial points it's pinned. It depends on the initial time, which we've taken to be 0. The construction of this functional form automatically, I emphasize that and underline it, automatically leads to this expression being equal to a coherent state matrix element of e to the minus I h, a Hamiltonian operator, capital T, divided by h bar, p prime, q prime, and it tells us, this functional form tells us, I'll give you the clue in a minute how it does that, this functional form tells us what those states are and what the Hamiltonian is. It says that these states are given, as I've introduced to you to them already, by the coherent states. It is automatic that that state is the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, normalized. It's automatic consequence that the Q's and P's satisfy the Heisenberg commutation relation. And it says further that the Hamiltonian operator is given by a weighted sum of the projection operators onto the one-dimensional coherent state vectors. So back-to-back P's and Q's, integrate dp dq over 2 pi h bar, is the construction of the very Hamiltonian operator H, which is associated with this problem. Okay, so now we're ready for the third condition. Third condition says that the operator H, as represented by equation double star, which is this equation, is essentially, I'll explain the words in a minute, essentially self-adjoint on the domain D, composed of vectors which themselves are finite linear combinations, n equals 0 to capital N, complex coefficient AN, of the number operators, which I will write as the creation operator to power N acting on the ground state, where the ANs are complex, they're in the complex family, and N is a finite number. Okay, so that's a set of vectors in the space. It's not all vectors in the Hilbert space, it's called a dense set. And we want this operator to be essentially self-adjoint when acting on those. Essentially self-adjoint means there is one and only one generator associated with it making a unitary operator. So there's only one and only one unique unitary operator associated with that Hamiltonian on this set of vectors. Okay, so let me give you a rich set of functions H, a class of suitable functions H, P, and Q is as follows. All semi-bounded polynomials in P and Q. We've already seen under this very prescription how this function and the operator are connected. I wrote that down previously. If I take a power series of creation operators here and annihilation operators on this side, that is the anti-normal ordered form, then that coincides here with this expression like that. So here is a weight function, and here is the operator that it creates. Clearly, I put this in a specific order. That has to be in order for this thing to be so functionally similar to it. But it clearly, polynomial of these goes to polynomial of those. So it's all semi-bounded polynomial. Of course, I want them to be Hermitian. Combinations of capital P and capital Q would be adequate, would be covered by this theorem. Of course, I don't need to have polynomials. There's nothing restricting this to be a polynomial. This didn't have to be a polynomial. It could be a rational function of polynomials or something more bizarre.
in order to have these things true. But this is just a simple class to illustrate that it's a very rich structure. Okay, how are we doing? Okay, there's something called the GNS theorem. GNS. It stands for Gelfand, Neimark, and Siegel. Gelfand, Neimark, Siegel theorem says the following. Let's take a function of labels. So I'll use labels like what we have. Notice I've dropped the T from this. So this will correspond, going to correspond to our situation where capital H will be zero. I beg your pardon. Little h will be zero. If that's zero, then the Hamiltonian is zero. If the Hamiltonian is zero, that's a unit operator, and we have simply the overlap of the coherent states. This is the situation then when h, hence little h, is identically zero. So this is a continuous function. So suppose this is, let's assume, k is a continuous function. And it is of positive type. Positive type. What does the function mean to be positive type? PJ, QJ, PK, QK, summation alpha J star, alpha K, J and K equal 1 to capital N is finite for all complex coefficients and all N, which are finite. Wrong statement. Greater than or equal to zero. That's what positive type is. So, of course, I'm leading to our particular example, but the theorem, of course, has nothing to do with coherent states or anything like that. You take a function of two sets of arguments, could be single arguments, double arguments, whole functions on either side, should be continuous, and be a positive type. Then, there exists Hilbert space, well, actually, separable Hilbert space vectors phi. I'll give it the mathematical kind of notation. Depending on one of your sets of labels, so that K of P double prime, Q double prime, semicolon, P prime, Q prime is represented by the inner product. Two vectors of that type. It's a marvelous theorem. And it's one I urge you to become a little more familiar with. Very valuable. This is the mathematical notation of inner product of vectors. We could say the same thing in our language by saying is given by the inner product of two general vectors in the Dirac notation, bracket, and in that case, you can actually determine the vectors, the properties of the vectors, and it is from that aspect, applying the GNS theorem to this expression, that we learned that the vectors have this form, the operators have this property, and furthermore, they satisfy the Heisenberg uncertainty relationship. Okay. There's several directions to go at this point. Let me choose one of those directions.
John?
Yes, question.
Before you realize that,
yes.
That h to the fourth,
yes.
Wouldn't work for Coulomb potential.
No.
That's okay.
And I don't advertise canonical coherent states for Coulomb potential. There's other groups, the affine group, so-called, which is much more useful, in my opinion, for the Coulomb. Okay. So I would like to go in three directions at once at this point, but that's not possible, so we have to do them sequentially. And here we go. There is a useful physical analog system. Which will help you understand what our expression is and why it actually works the way it works. Let me write it down one more time. I don't see it on the board at the moment. So I will put it up as we've been using it. Integral PQ dot minus H PQ dt minus 1 over 2 nu p dot squared plus q dot squared dt dp dq. Okay, now I'm going to give you first a classical description of this physical analog system and then a quantum description. And it won't look at the beginning exactly like what we've been talking about. So bear with me. I want to talk about a particle which is charged and moving in a magnetic field, and an auxiliary potential. What does Newton tell us to write down? He says M R vector double dot. So we're going to be in three dimensions. M R double dot equals E over C R vector, that's the velocity, cross magnetic field B. It takes care of the motion of the particle in the magnetic field. And here, according to Newton, in a conservative force field, the gradient of the potential. I'm going to separate out two of the dimensions, called x and y, and the z direction will be special. The z direction is the direction of the magnetic field. B points in the direction of the magnetic field. You remember your unit vectors I, J, K, with magnitude B. So my arrow also represents the B field. What do we know about a particle like that? This particle will traverse in circles due to this term around the magnetic field. If there's an extra potential, then there will be a gentle drift, let us call it, of the center point. I'm only going to concentrate the R vector. It's going to be really x, y, and I'm not going to worry about the z part. I'm not going to let this depend on z. So there's no force in the z direction. This does not contribute a force in the z direction.
this would be mz double dot equals zero, no acceleration, so there could be a drift, z could be moving uniformly up or down, but I'm going to say z dot equals zero, and in particular, I'll just set z equals zero, I'll freeze it at point zero. So our motion of our particle takes place in the plane xy. We're pointing toward the quantum Hall effect, for those of you who want to think about that. Okay. Now, for the quantum Hall effect, you don't really talk about this part so much. You make a very, very strong magnetic field, B. In the quantum theory, we know that these circular motions are quantized in so-called Landau levels. And the energy spacing in there is proportional to the cyclotron frequency, which is given by the electric charge, the magnetic field, divided by the velocity of light, and the mass of the particle. When you make the magnetic field very, very large, you make the cyclotron frequency very large, and cyclotron frequency is related to the spacing of the levels of the Landau energy level. Now, there is a zero-point energy, so I write that as half step here. This is half step. These are full steps after that. But as, and this distance is proportional to omega c, and so b gets large, omega c gets large, I can push all these other levels high, and so I can concentrate my physics into this lowest Landau level. Now, the poor experimentalists have to deal with electrons. Electrons come with a fixed mass, they have no choice, but if they want to make this quotient large, they have to raise the magnetic field. As a theorist, I don't have to do that. I can do the other thing, I can make the mass small. So I'm going to let the mass go to zero as a way to make this thing very large. What happens when this equation has m goes to zero? Then I have zero equals e over c r vector cross b minus gradient v. Only the velocity appears. The acceleration does not appear anymore. Let me put this in its two-component form, x and y. So I know that b points in the z direction. There's an x and a y here, and there's a gradient over here. And I'm going to let the little combination e times magnitude of b times c, I'll call that little b. So what we find out is b y dot equals the gradient of v with respect to x, and bx dot equals minus the gradient of v with respect to y. Those are the two equations of motion that result after having taken m to zero. Let me borrow part of the b, a square root of it, and put it over here next to this x. Square root of this b and put it over next to this y. Now we change the names of things. I'm going to let square root of b times y call that q. Square root of b times x we'll call that p. Then we have q dot, that's this part. Oh yeah, I'm going to change v of x and y, I'm going to change that into a new name, h. You would be happier if I called it capital H, but I want to do it this way, of p and q. So I have q dot is minus, equals partial of h with respect to p, and p dot equals minus partial of h with respect to q. I have recovered Hamilton's equation for a single degree of freedom, whereas I had Newton's equations for 2 degrees of freedom. When the m was finite, we had 2 genuine degrees of freedom, x and y.
acceleration for both. When the m goes out, I lose that second derivative, and I have got a system equivalent to a single canonical variable.
Okay. Let's put that now into action for us for quantum theory.
And try to make a comparison with this expression.
How would I write down the path integral for my original problem? This problem right here.
I would write it down integral e to the I by h bar Lagrangian, depending on x and y and x dot and y dot dt, curly dx, curly dy, integral script n. That would be my propagator, a la Feynman, for this system. I can use the Lagrangian because we have traditional kinetic energy terms. There's no relativistic nonsense going on. At this point, I remind you that the Lagrangian for such a system is equal to m over 2 x dot squared plus y dot squared, that's kinetic energy, plus a term which is the magnetic potential x comma y dot velocity minus my potential, what I had before. Now, in truth, I probably have an E over C, but I'm beginning to get careless about the symbols, the constants. We have to find out what a suitable vector potential is to give us a constant magnetic field. We know that curl A equals B, and our B wants to be 0, 0, a constant in the third direction. The choice that we make for A is not unique. We can add a gradient to A, and we know that the curl of the gradient vanishes. I will choose A to be 0, B, x, 0. I will choose it to be proportional to my little symbol B, which is proportional to capital B. So I don't have my E over C outside anymore. I have it in the second position. This is A sub 2, if you like, but it depends on x. So let's put that together. Oh, I assure you that if you take a derivative of this, if you take the curl of that A, there will be something which is a d by the x of the second component. D by the x of AY will give you a BZ. And that's exactly what I want. Okay. So let's put that together in our path integral. So we have e to the I over h bar integral b y x, no, b x y dot, because that's the second component of A, therefore that goes with the second component of the R vector, minus V of x comma y, plus M over 2, x dot squared plus y dot squared, dg, dx, dy. Let's put in my choice of variables here. E to the I by h bar, I get a p q dot. This becomes little h of p and q. And over here, I'm going to keep it like it is for the moment. So I've got the first part exactly like I want. I'm interested in, of course, some normalization, which will help me, depending on my parameter. My parameter is the mass at this point, but we're going to change that. And I'm going to take the limit as that parameter goes to zero. Okay, how do I do that? I'm going to let m go to zero, that's part of the game, but I'm going to replace it by something upside down, and I'll call that nu. So nu will go to infinity. Actually, there's an h bar here and not here. As m goes to zero, that's the same as nu going to infinity. And if m goes to zero, it's not a great matter whether it goes to zero along the real line or along the imaginary line. So let me take it along the imaginary line, and I'll pick up a minus in front of that instead of an I. And now, I've arranged things constant-wise, don't worry about it. So this becomes p dot squared plus q dot squared. And then my integration variables become dp, dq, and anything from the b is, I either set the b equal 1 or absorb it into the normalization. Now, this object then, together with that, is exactly what we had over here. How do we understand the strange factor in front when we make this mathematical? We make it mathematical by doing this to it. We have a 2 pi h bar here. Then we have this funny looking thing, u the nu t over 2 h bar. Limit. Can we understand the physics of that? Yes, we can. As I'm taking the mass to zero, I am raising the cyclotron frequency. All the higher levels are receding in energy far, far away. But even the ground state is being torn away from zero energy because of the ground state energy. If I kept that, that would be e to the minus omega c, so that's like an h bar omega c energy over 2. So that's something like an e to the minus 1 over m. I'm already in the changed sign world, times the time amount, how much time was involved, would be something like that, and it would disappear. The whole amplitude would disappear. So I have to re-amplify it. And that is exactly what this factor is. This comes from the zero point energy of the first Landau level that has to be put in so that this limit does not go away. You can also understand a need for something like that very easily. Suppose I say 0 to t, and we look at the very special case of the coherent state overlap given by limit 2 pi e to the I 0 to t p dq. I set h equals 0, d measure. Now this is some measure of things running around on the floor, p and q, and I have a phase average here. That phase average will decrease that amplitude as time goes on. But on the left-hand side, there's no time dependence at all. So to compensate for that decrease of amplitude, I have to have a prefactor which restores that amplitude factor. And just by the group law of combination from 0 to t and then from t to further, that's a group combination law which tells you it has to be exponential. And then you could even do that to try it as a trial and error to see what the coefficient should be. Anyway, this comes from the zero point energy in the first Landau. See you on Friday.